Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Well, good afternoon. We're getting started with our discussion of the Torah reading Akev, which covers Deuteronomy chapter 7, starting in verse 12, and runs through most of chapter 11, kind of stopping in verse 25. So we'll be starting in verse 12 of Deuteronomy chapter 7. Then it shall come about, because you listen to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord your God will keep with you his covenant and his loving kindness, which he swore to your forefathers. He will love you and bless you and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your ground, your grain and your new wine and your oil, the increase of your herd and the young of your flock, in the land which he swore to your forefathers to give you. You shall be blessed above all peoples. There will be no male or female barren among you or among your cattle. The Lord will remove from you all sickness, and he will not put on you any of the harmful diseases of Mitzrayim, which you have known. But he will lay them on all who hate you. You shall consume all the peoples whom the Lord your God will deliver to you. Your eye shall not pity them, nor shall you serve their gods, for that would be a snare to you. If you would say in your heart, "These nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them?" You shall not be afraid of them. You shall well remember what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all Mitzrayim, the great trials which your eyes saw, and the signs and wonders, and a mighty hand and the outstretched arm by which the Lord your God brought you out. So shall the Lord your God do to all the peoples of whom you are afraid. Moreover, the Lord your God will send the hornet against them until those who are left and hide themselves from you perish. You shall not dread them, for the Lord your God is in your midst, a great and awesome God. The Lord your God will clear away these nations before you little by little. You will not be able to put an end to them quickly, for the wild beasts will grow too numerous for you. But the Lord your God will deliver them before you and will throw them into great confusion until they are destroyed. You will deliver their kings. He will deliver their kings into your hands so that you will make them, their name, perish from under heaven. No man will be able to stand before you until you have destroyed them. The graven images of their gods you are to burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them, nor take it for yourselves, or you will be ensnared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord your God. You shall not bring an abomination into your house, and like it shall come under the ban. You shall utterly detest it, and you shall utterly abhor it, for it is something banned. Chapter 8. All the commandments that I am commanding you today, you shall carefully do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your forefathers. You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you and let you be hungry, and led you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Thus you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you, just like a man disciplines his son. Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land where you will eat food without scarcity, in which you will not lack anything, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes which I am commanding you today. Otherwise, when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold multiply and all that you have multiplies, then your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Mitzrayim, out of the house of slavery. He led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. He brought water for you out of the rock of flint. In the wilderness, he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good for you in the end. Otherwise, you might say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who has given you power to make wealth, that he may confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. It shall come about that if you ever forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I will testify against you today that you will surely perish. Like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so you shall perish, because you did not listen to the voice of the Lord your God. Chapter 9. Hear, O Israel, you are crossing over the Jordan today to go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than you, great cities fortified to heaven, a people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, whom you know and of whom you have heard it said, who shall stand before the sons of Anak? Know therefore today that it is the Lord your God who is crossing over before you as a consuming fire. He will destroy them, and he will subdue them before you, so that you may drive them out and destroy them quickly, just as the Lord has spoken to you. Do not say in your heart when the Lord your God has driven them out before you, because of my righteousness the Lord has brought me in to possess this land. But it is because of the wickedness of the nations that the Lord is dispossessing them before you. It is not for your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you are going to possess their land, but it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God is driving them out before you, in order to confirm the oath which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Know then, it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess. For you are a stubborn people. Remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness, from the day that you left the land of Mitzrayim until you arrived at this place. You have been rebellious against the Lord. Even at Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath. And the Lord was so angry with you that he would have destroyed you. When I went up to the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant which the Lord had made with you, then I remained on the mountain 40 days and nights, and I neither ate bread nor drank water. The Lord gave me the two tablets of stone written by the finger of God. On them were all the words which the Lord had spoken with you at the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly. It came about at the end of 40 days and nights that the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Then the Lord said to me, "Arise, go down from here quickly, for your people, whom you brought out of Mitzrayim, have acted corruptly. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made a molten image for themselves." The Lord spoke further to me, saying, "I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stubborn people. Let me alone, that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under the heaven. And I will make of you a nation mightier and greater than they." So I turned and came down the mountain, while the mountain was burning with fire, and the two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands. And I saw that you had indeed sinned against the Lord your God. You had made for yourselves a molten calf. You had turned aside quickly from the way which the Lord had commanded you. I took hold of the two tablets and threw them from my hands and smashed them before your eyes. I fell down before the Lord, as at the first, 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all your sin, which you had committed in doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure with which the Lord was wrathful against you in order to destroy you. But the Lord listened to me that time also. The Lord was angry enough with Aharon to destroy him. So I also prayed for Aharon at the same time. I took your sinful thing, the calf which you had made, and burned it with fire and crushed it, grinding it very small until it was fine as dust. And I threw its dust into the brook that came out from the mountain. Again, at Terebah, and at Massah, and at Kibroth Hatavah, you provoked the Lord to wrath. When the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea, saying, "Go up and possess the land which I have given you," then you rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. You neither believed him nor listened to his voice. You have been rebellious against the Lord from the day I knew you. So I fell down before the Lord the 40 days and nights, which I did because the Lord had said he would destroy you. I prayed to the Lord and said, "O Lord God, do not destroy your people, even your inheritance, whom you have redeemed through your greatness, whom you have brought out of Mitzrayim with a mighty hand. Remember your servants, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Do not look at the stubbornness of this people, or at their wickedness or their sin. Otherwise, the hand from which you brought us may say, 'Because the Lord was not able to bring them into the land which he had promised them, and because he hated them, he has brought them out to slay them in the wilderness.' Yet they are your people, even your inheritance, whom you have brought out by your great power and your outstretched arm." Chapter 10. At the time the Lord said to me, "Cut out for yourself two tablets of stone like the former ones, and come up to me on the mountain, and make an ark of wood for yourself. I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets, which you shattered, and you shall put them in the ark." So I made an ark of acacia wood, and cut out two tablets of stone like the former ones, and went up on the mountain with the two tablets in my hand. He wrote on the tablets, like the former writing, the Ten Commandments which the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them to me. Then I turned and came down from the mountain, and they put the tablets in the ark which I had made, and there they are, as the Lord commanded me. Now the sons of Israel set out from Beeroth B'nai Yakan to Maserah, where Aharon died and there was buried, and Eleazar, his son, ministered as priest in his place. From there, they set out to Gudabah, and from Gudabah to Yohadbad, a land of brooks of water. At that time, the Lord set apart the tribe of Levi to carry the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, to stand before the Lord, to serve Him, and to bless in His name until this day. Therefore, Levi does not have a portion or inheritance with his brothers. The Lord is his inheritance, just as the Lord, your God, spoke to him. I, moreover, stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights like the first time. The Lord listened to me that time also, and the Lord was not willing to destroy you. Then the Lord said to me, arise, proceed on your journey ahead of the people, that they may go in and possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require from you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all His ways and to love Him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the Lord's commandments and His statutes, which I am commanding you today for your good. Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the highest heavens, the earth and all that is in it. Yet on your fathers did the Lord set His affection to love them, and He chose their descendants after them, even you above all peoples, as it is this day. So circumcise your heart and stiffen your neck no longer. For the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, the awesome God, who does not show partiality nor take a bribe. He executes judgment for the orphan and the widow, and shows His love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. So, show your love for the alien, for you were aliens in the land of Mitzrayim. You shall fear the Lord your God, you shall serve Him and cling to Him, and you shall swear by His name. He is your praise, and He is your God, who has done these great and awesome things for you, which your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Mitzrayim, 70 persons in all, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. Chapter 11. You shall therefore love the Lord your God and always keep His charge, His statutes, His ordinances, and His commandments. Know this day that I am not speaking with your sons who have not known and have not seen the discipline of the Lord your God, His greatness, His mighty hand, and His outstretched arm, and His signs and His works, which He did in the midst of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the king of Egypt, and to all his land, and what He did to the army of Mitzrayim, to its horses and its chariots, when He made the water of the Red Sea engulf them while they were pursuing you, and the Lord completely destroyed them, and what He did to you in the wilderness until you came to this place, and what He did to Datan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, the sons of Reuben. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them, their households, their tents, and every living thing that followed them among all Israel. But your own eyes have seen all the great work of the Lord which He did. So therefore keep every commandment which I am commanding you today, so that you may be strong and go in and possess the land into which you are about to cross to possess it, so that you may prolong your days on the land which the Lord swore to your fathers to give them and to their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land into which you are entering to possess it is not like the land of Mitzrayim from which you came, where you used to sow your seed and water it with your foot like a vegetable garden. But the land into which you are about to cross to possess it, the land of hills and valleys, drinks water from the rain of heaven, a land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning even to the end of the year. It shall come about, if you listen obediently to my commandments, and which I am commanding you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, that he will give the rain for your land in its season, the early and late rain, that you may gather in your grain and your new wine and your oil. He will give grass in your fields for your cattle. You will eat and be satisfied. But beware that your hearts are not deceived, and that you do not turn away and serve other gods and worship them. For the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain. The ground will not yield its fruit, and you will perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. And you shall therefore impress these words of mine on your heart and on your soul, and you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall teach them to your sons, talking of them when you sit in your house and when you walk along the road, and when you lie down and when you rise up. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, so that your days and the days of your sons may also be multiplied on the land which the Lord swore to your fathers to give them, as long as the heavens remain above the earth. For if you are careful to keep all this commandment which I am commanding you to do, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways and hold fast to him, then the Lord will drive out all these nations before you. And you will dispossess nations greater and mightier than you. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours. Your border will be from the wilderness to Lebanon, and from the river, the great river Euphrates, as far as the western sea. No man will be able to stand before you. The Lord your God will lay the dread of you and the fear of you on all the land on which you set foot, as he has spoken to you. So those little sheets I handed out, as we had talked about last time around, is the overview of the book of Deuteronomy. And one of the things that we had talked about is that much of Deuteronomy is an overview and talks a lot about an overview and elaboration on the Ten Commandments. So explains more of them in detail. So it kind of helps to fill in some of the details of what each of the commandments mean. But one of the things that you probably heard going on in great length during this discussion here today was talking about how the Lord is not going to forget. The Lord is not going to forget. The people may forget, but the Lord is not going to forget. So one of the things that we can say when it talks about, you know, love the Lord. Well, one of the things that we should pay attention in this section, and as we continue to chug through, is that you are seeing the heart of God. The heart of God as faithful. That he, when he makes promises, he's going to follow through with them. So, there might be many times you might hear today people saying, well, the state of Israel that we see now is nothing to do with any sort of things in prophecy. And, you know, God has moved on from Israel and now has the bigger plan in mind. Well, one of the things that we'll take a look at in this is that if that might be an easy thing to say because of the harsh corrections that you see in quite a few of these encounters that the Lord has, but should ask ourselves, what does that mean about the Lord's promises? If the Lord turns his promises off like a light switch on us, wow, that would be a pretty bad situation. We have a comment down here in front.
That would tell us we couldn't trust him, but he doesn't do that.
Yeah, when it talks about faithfulness, that faithfulness has limits. And it's limits that you might say are shorter than mankind. In this passage we saw, a remembrance of the encounters there with the golden calf. We'll get into that a little bit more as we go along there. Well, in the recounting and in the original accounts, what was the, you could say, corrective, on the surface, what was the corrective thing that kept the people from being destroyed? Moses. So one could say, just on a surface reading of this, well, Moshe has a lot more loyalty, forgiveness, faithfulness than the Lord does. Because the Lord was ready to say, I'm done with them. Moshe stepped in and said, no, please forgive. So that's one of the things that we should say. Well, we should be very careful to start, you know, attributing our lack of patience and saying that the Lord also has the same lack of patience. Yes.
I couldn't get out of here. It repeats that he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, but did he do it like three different times, or is he just repeating the same time? Because it sounds like some of them were different times. So each time he just fell on his face for 40 days and 40 nights and went without food, just praying for forgiveness for these people that God wouldn't destroy him.
Yeah, the first time was for the first set of the Ten Commandments, the first tablets of the testimony. Then, after the golden calf, went back again. And when you were saying about the interceding, again, this interceding was going on again for then the tablets of the testimony again. This is the one that then Moshe, you know, carved them out. Well, I don't know. It doesn't mention that he ate in between that time. But certainly not in the time that's going up again. Well, you might also notice in there where it talked about the 40 years and their shoes didn't wear out and such like that. And they mentioned the manna. Just kind of side mention about that stuff that came down, you know, for six mornings each week. That should indicate that, wow, he was being sustained and moving along. But still, that was also a good example of the same kind of heart that we should have. That kind of love that Moshe had for the people, even though you can see the examples where he also lost his patience with it, but still, he had a heart that said, please forgive. And also the one about the plague where he sent his brother, Aharon, running into the midst, say, hey, atone, intervene. Stop this plague. So, kind of a good example of how we should be extremely careful to really pay attention to what is going on, not what we might think is going on just from a pretty surface reading. And we have a question over here. Yeah, last week we talked about
commandments, ordinance, and statutes.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that, it has any other meaning. I mean, are there three things to consider?
Well, I mean,
he said it twice about the statute.
You think about it, that piece of paper I passed around about the outline of the book, and a good chunk of it has the elaboration of the ten. That's kind of a good example of commandments, ordinances, and you know, statutes. Because what you see with that is, just like you were talking about last week, was that you have what is set down, okay, do this. And then you have, we might call it case law, things, applications for them, but they may not apply in all situations. They are the application of the more basic principle to something going down. So thus, for much of Devarim or Deuteronomy, you've got the commandments, the ten, expressed in ordinances, which is going on at length on various topics, and we'll get on to a few of them today, more of these. And then, from there, how that gets applied in actual life. And you see, well, inside the Torah and the prophets, you've got not only just those ten, but then you've got the others. People have enumerated them different ways. A common way is the 613, but inside the 613 are contained in there, you would call them the ordinances, so the things like, okay, this is what you should do, and then the case law, examples of them. You know, the daughters of Zelophehad. That's an example of a case law or a statute where you're just saying, okay, we've got this general principle that the inheritance has to go down. Okay. And that goes up to the basic principle, which is, and we call that number one, the first commandment. I'm the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Mitzrayim, the land of slavery. So out of that, I am the one who took you out. Then we get, okay, he's going to take them out, and he's going to take them somewhere. And that somewhere is the land. And that land is divided up. The land is divided up based on inheritance. So from there, you've taken from the one and have now gotten it down to the ordinances. Okay, you're going to divvy it up by tribe. We're going to do it by lot. And then we get down to a case law example with these daughters. It's like, okay, well, this is going through sons. Now what about if the guy has got only daughters? What do you do in that situation? So that is a case where that general principle there in the Ten Commandments came down to a more expanded into a number of ordinances about inheritance of the land, and then down into a specific example of the daughters. So does that help at all to kind of see how it kind of filters down from the basic 10 down to lots of them, and then down to a specific example or application of these? Pick out the statutes, which we call them like case law, come from the ordinances, which come from the commandments. Yes. Well, that's why we were going through this in the Torah, is we can see these are specific applications. So we can see as we're going through, and you see it in the historical writings, and then you see them in the prophets, where he is like saying, okay, this is the general principle, this is what I want you to do about it, and this is what's happened, and this is what's going to happen because of it. So that's kind of like what you see of all, so when he's talking about his statutes, that's why we should be extremely careful about when we are taking his applications to things and then taking them into what we think they should go beyond that. So that's why it's very important to sort out, are you looking at a commandment, an ordinance, or a statute? So I hope that helps a bit, because yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to encounter some ordinances, and then in those cases we'll encounter some statutes or case law that's come out from that. So just as we're going through and where we're kind of at, we're in this midst of gone through the first address during the last time around, which is the historical recap of how we got here, how the people are getting into the land. So we're down into what you call Moshe's second address, which goes from chapter 4 through chapter 28, and down into the section started in chapter 6 of Deuteronomy, runs through chapter 26 of elaboration on the Ten Commandments. And so last time around, we started in on that with chapter 6 on what we call the first commandment on, you know, have no other gods before me. I'm Lord, it took you out. So today we're going to be covering chapter 7, you know, follow the Lord rather than the nations. Chapter 8, do not forget the Lord your God. Chapter 9, a good chunk of chapter 10 is about not boasting in your own righteousness. And then chapter 11 kind of finishes out, and we're taking a part of that and looking at another reminder to keep the commands of the Lord. So, did you get a handout? Oh, yeah, there was a... Oh, there you go.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so as we start out with this discussion here today, in like chapter 7 of Deuteronomy, the first place that we get to is in really the first verse, is kind of where we get the title of this passage here today of Akev. And Akev, you could translate it either because or as a consequence of. So thus in that first verse of our passage in 7 verse 12, then it shall come about because, Akev, you listen to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord your God will keep with you his covenant and his loving kindness, which he swore to your fathers. So again, you've got that if then. If you continue on, and you see in chapter 7, it's a pretty nice situation. The Lord is going to clear out everything before you. Things are going to go well for you as you go and you enter the land. So when we get down to our first couple of things that people have noticed as ordinances, which are down in chapter 7, verses 25 and 26. So there we get about, okay, you're going into land, everything is great, but, and there's the big but, not to keep around everything that's in the land. The graven images of their gods you are to burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them, nor take it for yourselves, for you will be ensnared by it. For it is an abomination to the Lord your God. You shall not bring an abomination into your house, and like it, come under the ban. You shall utterly detest it, and you shall utterly abhor it, for it is something banned. So thus we see an application of that, or you could say this is the ordinance. So what was the application of this? What happened, or of course this later in Israel's history, but what happened when the Israel went in and took Jericho? There was, well, they burned it down. Except. So, what was the except? Yeah, souvenirs. Well, yeah. You might not say souvenirs, but yes. Don't take anything from it. Anything. I mean, this is in this part, it's talking about images of the gods, nothing that even they were made from. Don't, not even what they're made from. So, thus, if you've seen some of the very ancient commentaries on this, they talk about, you know, if you have an Asherah pole, it's not just about chopping it down and, you know, chop it down, maybe turn it into, you know, maybe a post in your home, maybe make some skis out of them or something fun like that. No, it goes up in smoke. So thus you see that come down as an application of that. Okay, don't have anything inside your house. You might say a case law part of that comes down to some of the early believers in Acts chapter 15. Because what was one of those four things? And if you need just a little refresher, let's just get your finger in there and let's just go over and take a look at those four things for the new believers coming in from the nations that you see in Acts chapter 15. Yep, staying from things sacrificed to idols, from blood, and from things strangled, and from fornication. So, you know, you got the things sacrificed to idols, and you see it reiterated even earlier in Acts chapter 15. So, this is, when you're talking about it, one of the, quote, more arcane parts of the Torah, because you're thinking, well, even in the first century AD, they weren't going in and taking over cities, the land, a land long been conquered, reconquered, reoccupied, resettled for a long, long, long time. But this was still something that was an issue. Well, why was this arcane bit of the Torah, you might say, quote, arcane, unquote, obscure, kind of seeming like it's obsolete long ago? Why is this then still one of the big four things that the apostles said, hey, new believers from the nations got to observe this?
Is that was the most
violated thing they were doing? So that would be, well, when we've gone from, have no other gods before me, I'm the Lord your God, to now the ordinance is that what you get from this, two that have been thought of from Deuteronomy 7, verses 25, 26, is, don't benefit from any ornaments that came onto an idol, like the silver and gold it specifically mentions. And then also, don't get wealthy from anything that's connected to an idol. So don't market and benefit from it. So you see it, it's like, oh, we banned it, but boy, I'm going to sell it for, I'm going to mark it up and put it on eBay and make a profit on it. So, no, you're not even going to benefit from that at all. So, again, why is this thing that seems like it's kind of obscure ends up being something that comes down as a big four? I mean, when people have wrestled with this for a couple thousand years, why is it that these new believers are given these four things and they're, quote, not of the Ten Commandments? On the surface, they're not of the Ten Commandments. Acts chapter 15, well, it's kind of mentioned a few times, one of which is down in, let's see, verse 29, is kind of reiterated again. So, yeah, it's mentioned a few times, but kind of crystallized also in verse 29. So, again, why is this so important for these new believers? Well, one of those things that you have there is about eating the blood, things sacrificed to idols. One of the things we've talked about on long ago when you're going through Acts is that this was a culture, kind of Greek, and then kind of spilled over into Roman culture, kind of incorporated these things from the times before them. Much of the big empires ended up, like a vacuum cleaner of the practices of the nations around them, to a certain degree. Some of the earlier, quote, superpowers, unquote, didn't vacuum up as much as the later ones, but as it went down into Greece and Rome, they had incorporated some of the deities from the empires before them, sucked them in as a part of their practices. So, thus, you read about them as we go through the apostolic writings that they had some temples to various deities that were common in certain places, in certain cities, were dedicated to certain deities. So this was something, if you had people who were coming in, these were new believers coming in from their old practices, their old way of life, this was something that they had to leave at the door. And they had to be very conscious of the things that they were bringing in, quote, with them. Remember, we talked before as we were going through about the Exodus, and it's like, leave all your stuff behind. Leave all your baggage behind. Not only just with the first Exodus, but also each of us when we have our own Exodus from our own house of bondage that we come out of, to leave that old life behind. Putting off the old man, as another way that Paul talks about putting off the old man, putting on the new man. That new man is something that's, when Israel is moving first from Mitzrayim up to Sinai, it should have been going from the old man. The old man should have been left in Mitzrayim. New man is kind of what you encounter, should have encountered a number of times heading up to even the mountain and then thereafter. But the problem, and And that's what Messiah kind of talks about in the Gospel of John, is where he talks about, well, they did not combine what they experienced with trust in God, trust in who they were leading. They still clung on to their old way of life, their old way of thinking. So thus, they did not leave the old man behind. The old man traveled with them. So thus, we're going to get to that in a minute when we get into Deuteronomy chapter 8, but the old man had to die in the desert. And that's what Messiah also gets at, is that that generation, they had to go because they weren't ready to enter the land. They weren't ready to become a new something new. Yeah, we have a comment over here. Yes. How do we feel about the Taliban blowing up the Buddhist statues?
They really did about 2 or 3 years ago over there in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Sounds like a good thing.
Well, sounds like a good thing. Well, one of the things that you have to remember in this is that we are not living under a theocracy in that sense. So with us not having the laws in which we all live under, thus, for example, if we were to use the U.S. military to basically enforce the Torah,
yeah,
how much do you think of the United States would be left?
Not much.
So thus, we are not, and sadly, okay, you could say they are under it, but one of those things is that is not our call at that particular time. So should we be, so glad that the statues are blown up? Well, one of those things that we could say is that we would not want to bring such things into our own house. So the things that we have control of. So that's why, kind of as the passage we're looking at today, it goes back to the same things about the sign on your hand and on your forehead, on the post of your gates. The things that you have control of. You have control over your mind. You have control over what you do. You have, hopefully, it's waning each day, but control over what goes on in your house, inside your household and your family. But beyond that, be careful. Because that's one of the things that the Messiah clashed at when he was... a lot of the clashes that you see recorded in the Gospels were on, you could say, something kind of similar to that, in the sense that there were the fence keepers, the fence minders in Israel society that were wanting to keep the fences around Torah and Torah behavior. Well, the challenge was is that where you have those fences get built by folk that have their own view of what the fences should be that vary from what the Lord actually said. So thus, your fences start to become walls, walls that block people from reaching and approaching God. And you saw that in a very physical sense where they have the separation there in the outer gate, courtyard of the second temple there in the first century. And, Paul makes hint of that, of the dividing wall between those of Israel and those of the nations, that coming down. To realize, just as the Apostle Peter had to, that when the Lord lifts people up, when he grafts them in, to use Paul's language, that when that happens, they're not like divided anymore. They are a part of the commonwealth of Israel, which is why Paul uses that term there in Ephesians. To realize that this, we should be trying to expand the commonwealth of Israel, not keep shutting doors on people and making it more exclusive. So, thus we can see there in Acts chapter 15 where you had a a few particular applications. You could say those statutes that come from ordinances, which come from commandments that came down about idolatry. So as we continue on, one of the kind of getting into Deuteronomy chapter 8, moving on into Deuteronomy chapter 8, it's kind of sad that, or maybe not so sad, that I was thinking back to one of the good examples or ways that might be able to help people understand the things that are mentioned in there about chapter 8 of Deuteronomy. And there's actually a very old song by that Shania Twain sang that actually fits into the direction, and hope you'll see in a bit as to what it's really getting at. And the chorus of it goes, "You've got to dance with the one that brought you, stay with the one that wants you, the one who's going to love you when all the others go home. Don't let the green grass fool you. Don't let the moon get to you. Dance with the one that brought you, and you can't go wrong." So, it's a very old kind of Southern aphorism, dance with the one who brung you. And that's the idea of, like, you stick to it, you're loyal. Loyalty for loyalty's sake. And often brought with, if you're stuck with some turkey players on a sports team, okay, you got to stick with them because it's about loyalty. But rather, what you see in godly wisdom brought forward is it's not just loyalty for loyalty's sake, but it's actually going with what is wise and sticking with what is wise and true versus being distracted and going off with what might be trendy, what ends up getting foolish, and things that are in a lot of cases false. So you see those aphorisms such as, the grass is greener on the other side, something that convinces you that, hey, this is a better practice. Well, getting to that later on in Deuteronomy, where it brings this up again, you see in chapter 8, where it says, hey, when you see the practices, how they worship their gods, don't do that. It may look fun, may look kind of inspiring, may kind of energetic, but be careful, because you don't realize what door it is that you're opening. So that's like what we saw there at the latter part of chapter 7 going into chapter 8. But they're about even the idols and stuff, the gold, the silver on them. You're like, well, shouldn't we recycle? Hey, we should recycle. We should scrape off that gold. We can repurpose the wood. It seems like such a waste to burn it. It kind of looks nice, kind of shiny. Wouldn't it be kind of nice to sit up there and on the mantle? Well, you could say, well, what harm does it do? What harm does it do? One of the things that you see in archaeology in the land of Israel, and you'll start seeing a lot of secular archaeologists go, aha, there was no one God in Israel. It was all just a made up stuff there in the latter part of time. Because when we dig up, we see these figurines. And some of them will say, it'll have the Lord's name, Yod-Heh-Waweh, and his Asherah on this figurine. And you're like, oh, how did that happen? Well, pretty kind of easy to see how that can happen for the various things that we're seeing mentioned there at the end of chapter 7 of Deuteronomy and going into chapter 8. We'll see later on in Deuteronomy. It's that these things that you think that you're taking in to your society, taking into your household, taking into your own practices, into your own homes, are not so innocuous and can be confusing. People start getting confused about what is true, what is not. Yes, we have a comment down here. Thinking about Christmas trees. Well, Christmas trees, you could say where that history comes from, and the Germanic tribes in Some people trace those even earlier, and those brought in and, quote, Christianized, unquote. Now, before you start getting all diabolical and, you know, Star Chamber-esque and Illuminati stuff, think about it on the surface level. People have a heart concern for other people who are going after other gods. And they say, well, what is a way that we can reach to them? How can we build a bridge? How can we build a bridge from where we are with our true beliefs to them and their foolish, false beliefs? Well, how about we just talk to them in language that they understand, and using symbols, using characters and such that they will understand. You know, sadly, we could say that there have been some apologists that have tried to do the same thing. C.S. Lewis, for all his books, wrote things that ended up confusing some people, because you'll have people that still get confused and totally lose sight of it. Yeah, if you come from a Christian background, you'll see the Christian imagery in it. But if you don't, it becomes another mythology. Same with J.R.R. Tolkien. Did the same thing. Tried to build a bridge. Fantastic works of the Tower series. But in the end, go on there and do a search on, you know, the Tolkien enthusiasts. How much of that is discussing the great wisdom from God's Word? Zippo. Zippo. Yeah, totally lost. So, it's one of those things that it sounds great on the surface, but the long-term effects of it. And see, that's why we always have to be careful about, as you know, the Hebrew term of, you know, lay olam, which is to the horizon and over the horizon, often described as forever, but really kind of beyond what you can see. And that beyond what we can see is the sight, the insight, the wisdom of the Lord helping us to see over the horizon where we are going. Yeah, we have a comment down here.
Well, it just looks like they were trying to compromise. I mean, if they're finding both different things, they were still trying to hang on to Yahweh, but they were also bringing in other stuff. And then over time, they lose track of who their God really is, and then he gets so distorted, like what happened to us. I mean, I was raised from babyhood with Christmas and Easter and all that stuff, and I never knew that that was wrong, that we weren't even, I had no idea that was false worship. You know, until I got that video from Alma.
Well, yeah, and there are things that you could say are completely innocuous. You would say, like, Bible stories and Bible movies. Are they great? Yes, they're great. But I remember, and I still have problems with some accounts that I only remember the movie account. And so when I actually read it in the Word, I'm like, that's not how I remember it. Yes, right. I don't remember it that way because I heard it too much the other way. So it's one of those things when it talks about teaching your children as you go about and as you wake up and go to bed, be very careful as to how you can teach that and how you communicate it and what symbols, what stories, what lessons. Yes.
As a parent, or as we're adults speaking to children in general, we do the same process all the time. We know that children understand certain words, certain language, certain vocabulary. So we explain things in those terms. Problem is, if we end there, we brought the child up to child level understanding and then left it. Moved on to the next child. It doesn't work. The child doesn't end there. You keep going. So although it may have been a noble idea in that, okay, let's see, use language that these other cultures understand and terms they understand, but the drawback is when you stop, you failed. All you did was just pollute everything. It's so different when Paul went over the Mars Hill thing. Using an example which they all understand. He didn't stop saying, this is your God, and walk away. He said, wait, there's more to this God. He explained more about where he came from, who he is, details about it he didn't know. There's nothing wrong with using their symbols to explain them to, but don't stop. Finish the whole conversation. Finish it off to the end, leading them completely away from it, which is the goal. The drawback is, if I do that to person A for 4 minutes, good, he's converted. Person B, next. Okay, now, person A, go convert the next guy. And wait a minute, you failed miserably. All you did was just propagate the lie and let it get spread from generation to generation to generation over and over and over for hundreds of years, and you screwed the whole thing up. Instead of saying, wait a minute, person A, let's keep going and walk the whole process through. I was talking to Nathan Covey earlier today. The prophets were really, really good when they were instructors. And who do they instruct? 2, 3, 4 people max. Their whole lives. They spent their whole lives teaching these 3 or 4 people until that instructor then dies. And these people take over the job. They didn't instruct them for 10 minutes or an hour or even a year of their life. It was their whole lives because the teaching process never ends. But they didn't teach him and then say for 10 minutes or an hour or even a year, so now go convert everybody. You just sent children out to go convert children, which will just, it's like playing a telephone game all over again. You mess the whole story up. So it's a good intent and technique to start a conversation. It's a disastrous way to continue or end a conversation.
Yeah, to perpetuate it from generation to generation. Well, one of the things,
I was just saying that really goes well with Acts, I think, 15, where they're saying, you know, stay away from these 4 things because they're going to learn as they continue to attend in the synagogues.
Yeah, it says that, you know, specifically is that because they are going to learn the full story each Shabbat, you know, learn directly from the source. A part of the loyalty that we see that's taught and really brought forward is we see a number of accounts of this loyalty, and a part of the commands, you know, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, the house of bondage. So have no other gods before me. So with all that, you're saying be loyal to the one who's brought you this far, has done so much for you, has been putting up with so much of your, you know, either disdain, dislike, disinterest, even outright hatred of the people against the one who was being so caring for them over such a long period of time. When you think of a number of the passages that really talk to this, staying with the one who brought you this far, staying with your first love. Some of the passages that makes me think of are like in Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 18. Proverbs chapter 5 verse 18, it says, let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. Brought even further on with Isaiah chapter 54 verse 6. For the Lord has called you like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit, even like a wife of one's youth when she is rejected, says your God. And continuing on in Malachi chapter 2, Malachi chapter 2, verses 13 through 16. In this case, you can really see because this particular, especially in chapter 2, where it really starts zeroing in and talking about the priests in particular, and where they have not been faithful in what they're doing. And you can see with that faithlessness of those who were supposed to be most faithful to keeping the knowledge of God, keeping the worship of God going. Malachi chapter 2, verse 13. For what reason? Oh, I'm sorry. It kind of goes up earlier. This is another thing that you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping, and with groaning, because he no longer regards the offering or accepts it with favor from your hand. Yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But not one has done so who is a remnant, who has a remnant of the Spirit. And what did that one do while he was seeking a godly offspring? Take heed then to your spirit, and let no one deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. For I hate divorce, says the Lord, the God of Israel, and him who covers his garment with wrong, says the Lord of hosts. So take heed to your spirit, that you do not deal treacherously. So thus you've got this little microcosm speaking to the priests and saying to the priests, hey, a little microcosm, a little, you could say, a snippet, a zeroing in of what the problem is, why it is that it seems like the Lord's not listening to you. Well, how is it that you're treating the one who should be the closest to you? How is it you, priest, and how you're treating your wife? And even to the point where priests are divorcing their wives. You're thinking about, you know, people that should be the least ones to be divorcing their wives. Wow. Those that should be closest to God. But, you know, you see what can happen when you take your eyes off of what some of the true issues are. So, in a sense, with the priesthood, it's like, my main job here is to do what? We talked about this going through Leviticus. Purpose of the sanctuary was for the people to come in the door, and they were to be brought near to the presence of God through the korbanot, through the offerings. And the ones who were to do that. So you think this is an incredible responsibility that these priests have of taking the people close to God through the various levels of the priesthood. Yet, one of the things that they're neglecting is their own closest relationships. So thus, you know, the Lord is telling the priesthood, hey, you're starting to see a problem in the connection between me and you, priesthood? Well, it's a symptom of a deeper heart issue that's also showing up in your relationship with the one that you're most close to. Another one that's I always think of a lot is found in Proverbs, again, Proverbs 31, a favorite passage for a lot of people, in verse 30. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who loves the Lord, she shall be praised. Because that love of the Lord is something that won't change with time, and hopefully it just gets better and stronger with time. The other things, like it talks about charm, it's using the same term of favor. Someone's favor can fade over time. Their beauty can fade over time. But what are the things that truly last? In our last study, we were talking about the legacy that you pass down from one generation to the next. That the words of the Lord are the greatest legacy that you can give. Because think of how they can change, the medium can change, but the message doesn't. Because one of the greatest things that the secularists have always had a problem with is the idea of information, and information pointing back to a mind and intelligence. And one of the hallmarks of information is that information, not just sort of random blips, static, whatever, you know, patterns of a snowflake that can just happen because of physics or whatever, but how you know, and a good emblem of that, is that this message will get between two people in all kinds of different media. You know, for example, you could go out on a beach and write the Shema on sand. and it would communicate it to anyone who saw it. Anyone who saw it could get the message. And you could put the Shema on paper, you can record it, you can sing it, you can put it in Braille. You know, you can even do it in Morse code with a shofar if you wanted to. And it would still communicate the Shema to people. So one of the things that the great legacy that we can have that survives from generation to generation is the wisdom of the Lord. And part of in chapter 8 of Deuteronomy and chapter 7 they're talking about be careful what things you bring in is this message is so precious. Don't be careful about how you corrupt it and how easily this message can get corrupted in coming through. So be careful that when you're passing this along from generation to generation, that you are doing it faithfully. And one of those great messages that's inside this is about the Lord's faithfulness. So when we get down to like Deuteronomy in the first few verses of Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 2 through 6. Yeah, Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 2 through 6. It brings up, it's like, well, why was this wandering in the desert? Why? Why were they wandering? And it specifically says here, you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you to know what is in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you and let you be hungry, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Thus you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you, just as a man disciplines his son. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to fear him. Some of those, the key things that we have in that passage about humbling you. And that humbling part there, the Hebrew word ana, is something we'll be discussing soon. We're about ready to be heading into the sixth month, and when we get into the seventh month with the Yom HaKippurim, or the Day of Atonement, when it talks about there, and we'll see in Leviticus 16, and it's brought up in some of the parallel passages, like in Leviticus 16 and Leviticus 23 and Numbers 29. It's even mentioned in Isaiah 58. It talks about humbling, 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 humbling. And that humbling being connected to food. Going without food in that regard. So, in this case, what he's talking about a disciplining, a testing, a humbling. But what is the purpose? Just to starve the people? Yeah, well, one of these things that we would see with the testing is what do you do when you are humbled? When you are humbled down, what is it that you do? Yeah, we have a comment back there.
Also to tell the flesh that it's not in control. The nefesh is not in control. Today you are not going to have food and water, and then you tell it to shut up and sit down and relax. That, you know, you're gonna obey the commands, and today you're gonna go without food.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting. I was just reading recently in 1 Corinthians, and it mentions there Paul in his letter was having to deal with a member of that congregation who mentions there was doing something pretty reprehensible even in secular circles there, where he was having a relationship with his father's wife. And then you see some of the arguments, and it seemed like it was brought up in some earlier letters, because it mentions In some modern versions, it helps you out a bit because it puts some quotation marks around some of the statements, like, you know, food for the body and the body for food is where it talks about there. Because, what just as kind of a sideline, one of the reasons why it's thought as that is a quotation and not like Paul is saying, hey, food for the body for food. This is your new commandment. No. Because he just goes right on after to say, well, that's a stupid that's a stupid way to run your life. So thus you're thinking, hey, he's actually responding to something, not actually giving you an instruction. Hey. But one of the things that you get with that discussion there in 1 Corinthians, and where it talks about, well, the body for food and food for the body, is just that. If you have, in that case, that person's desire to do something, wow, keep that in check. Pay attention to what it is that's going on inside your skull. And people talk about having a filter between your things that pop into your head and your mouth. Well, and the Apostle Yaakov talks about how your tongue is kind of like a huge ship, or your body is like the ship and your tongue is like the rudder, and wow, your tongue can steer you into all kinds of disaster pretty easily if you don't put a filter in between your brain and your tongue. Well, also your brain and the actions and the things that you do. And in that case that Paul was addressing there in 1 Corinthians was an issue. Someone had a desire to do something. They just said, I'm going to go forward and do that. So it's very kind of similar to the discussion we're talking about back here in Deuteronomy 7 and 8 here so far, is that the things that come across your eyes, the things that you may be tempted to do, pay attention to what your desires are. Pay attention to where those desires are headed. And it drops in this thing, this reminder, hey, 40 years. There were some times where, you know, your parents, they were hungry. Sometimes they were thirsty. But did the Lord leave them there to die?
No.
It wasn't sort of some afterthought where the Lord had no idea that this was going to happen. In those cases, he purposely pushed the people into places where they would be hungry for a while and they would be thirsty for a while. And in this particular passage here in Deuteronomy chapter 8, it talks about testing you to see whether you would love the Lord or not. Testing in how do you react? How do you react to a given situation? To the stresses that come in on your life? How do you react to it? Yes. Yes, hangry. We even have a word for it. Yes.
I want to eat now.
I'm hungry.
So we have to learn to control that kind of impulse and remember. Is
because
that what that means?
That impulse is natural. We're going to talk about, you know, people have all kinds of reactions to levels of blood sugar and this and that. Some people more so than others. But one of those things is, you know, you don't feel good. A lot of people get headaches, really bad ones. I know I do. And it doesn't take much to a little blood sugar out of whack, and you're really starting to feel it. Well, just like what Deborah was bringing up there as well, who is in control here? Is your body in control? Because, you know, if you've ever read any sort of testimony from our brothers and sisters who've come on to all kinds of stress, whether you're talking about in the things, times are recorded in the Bible, or things recorded thousands of years later, or even to this very day here in some terrible places, little corners of the world. I mean, they're under horrifically bad situations. But you hear some of the testimonies, and it sounds like the Apostle Paul there, singing in prison. Wow. I always think, every time I read that part in Acts, it's like, to be able to sing in the midst of prison. I get a little... Yeah, to be able to sleep, to be perfectly calm. You know, Messiah pointed this out there when he was asleep in the boat there during the storm in the lake. What was the lesson of that? His students should have been looking at him and his reaction to this situation, saying, wow, do we trust him? Do we trust him enough that if he's not worried, we shouldn't be worried either? Yes.
Well, I understand that part. We should trust him. We're maybe hungry now, but we know he's going to feed us eventually. Yeah. It might not be in this life.
Yeah.
But he's going to give us. But wasn't this more likely about, remember the guy who did feed you when you were in the wilderness?
Yes.
Remember him? Rather than worrying about whether or not it was angry at the moment. Yeah, we don't like it at the moment. And it says in the scriptures, you know, you get chastised. No one likes it while they're being chastised. But the reason for chastisement is to be for correction. Right. In the long term, it's love.
Yeah.
But for the, he doesn't say, and you should never be unhappy when you're being chastised. But he said, you're going to be unhappy.
You're going to be unhappy.
So,
but how is
that really what the most of the thing is? Remember the guy who took care of you in the wilderness?
Exactly. Because you're supposed to like look past the discomfort that you have at any particular moment. Look past the irritation that you have at any particular moment. To look past and see where it is that you've come. How far have you come so far? And that's one of the things that we can always, when you know, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when it talks about that when we're tempted, he will provide a way out. I don't know about you, but for me, that is remembering what he got me through in the last time this particular temptation came around. And the fact that actually choosing his way versus another way was actually the best way to go. So my particular desire, my particular anger, irritation at a given moment, that lasts, it may even last up to the time of my death. But which way is the actual better way to go? And to trust that it is actually the better way to go. So that is one of the great lessons that we can see through in this. Even just the small things and the spiritual discipline of fasting is that it is not just something to, okay, you get through so you get your ticket punched. Okay, I made it around through this time. This week, if you happen to be fasting on a weekly basis, or if it might be on the periodic fast, or if it's on the annual fast, the big one of Yom Kippur, whichever it is, it's not just a time to get your ticket punched. It is a time, you think of it as just like we in ancient Israel and we today as we reflect back on it, that the ancient people there would be humbling themselves as the high priest is going into the presence of God, you know, bearing on him all of the ick and yuck of all of the people, but also the covering for all of the people. And we can also think of just a couple of other examples that we've seen in this particular passage with talking about Moshe going up the mountain. Of his being without food and water. It doesn't mention, unlike what we see in the Gospels with Yeshua when the Spirit took him out into the wilderness and he was out there for 40 days. And it said at the end of those 40 days, what? He was hungry. It doesn't give that mention about what Moshe was experiencing, but you can sort of... It doesn't say that he was, but perhaps he was. But think about that. His desire was for what in all that time? Pushing past the hunger, the thirst. To receive the testimony of the Lord. To receive and also to intercede for the people. After the golden calf going up for another 40 days and 40 nights. To intercede for the people. So, you know, that's when you see that in the Gospels with Messiah there with the 40 days and 40 nights. That being a great example, not only of, you could say, a time of close bonding, but also a good sign for us about devotion. Devotion to the mission that was ahead of him. The mission of intercession, just as Moshe was interceding for the people. So Messiah be interceding for the people. Yes, we have a comment.
Oh, I just want to say that I've also learned that fasting isn't necessarily just that day for food, but I could fast, like perhaps I watch too much television or I eat something, and you to teach yourself to fast that particular thing too is another way to train the flesh to not be in control. So, you know, because I was sick when I was trying to fast, I felt lightheaded and everything. And I know that there's other things we can fast also too, like a particular food or anything that we might hyper focus on, you know. So,
yeah, because when the lessons there is, yeah, they strongholds are very strong, which is again,
they don't let you go.
Yeah, exactly. So even in what we were looking at the end of chapter 7 of Deuteronomy, when it talks about don't take these things, the idols and stuff, into your house. Well, there's the other things that we can take into our house. That, as someone so eloquently put it, you know, in Hollywood, they take out their garbage and put it on TV. But that might be an overgeneralization, but it's one of those things to be, we have a filter between our mind and our mouth. We should also have a filter between our eyes and our brain. Our brain should be communicating, hey, be very careful about the things that go into your ears, go into your eyes. Do you have a comment over here?
Right, I was going to... That thing about when Moses took the tablets and
yes.
broke them. I may be confusing this with the movie, but when he... I don't know how he got the tablets the first time. In the movie, it was the hand of God that carved them out. But the second one, he had to make them of himself and
yes.
take them back up. Are we to get anything from that, do you think?
What, had to make them?
Why did he have to take the tablets up the second time when the first time he went up there without tablets, he came back with tablets? Did we know? We don't know whether he carved them or not, but...
Think about the what we call the New Covenant prophecy there in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34. What is one of the key things that says? Write them on your hearts. Take those tablets of stone and replace them with hearts of stone and replace them with hearts of flesh. So one of those key things about cutting them out yourself and then God writing them on that, you could say it's very similar to that. Even in parts of Deuteronomy about wanting these things to be on your heart. These words shall be upon your heart, written on your heart, inscribed, carved into your heart. Yeah, perhaps almost you might say it as, bring to me the tablets of your heart and I will write my laws on them. Because that is what you see the New Covenant prophecy and you see it when it's emphasized and repeated a few times in the book of Hebrews. Broke the first, yeah. Well, it's kind of indicated that God provided those. That's kind of the picture that we get. So it's like even God provides it first, we break those, come back with the tablets of our heart, come back broken, and He will write them upon our hearts.
Second ones were made of wood.
Yeah, wait. Made of unbreakable plastic? No. So one of the things that we get with this testing is to know how we are going to react and about knowing the heart, how we will obey and why we obey. First off, will we actually obey? But then after we actually do say, okay, your way is the best way, then why is it that you want me to do this? Figure out the why. We remember our last session we were talking about, well, you know, do we do Do we do the what before the why or the why before the what? Or do we wrangle back and forth? And it's one of those things that we need to learn that this trust part involves the why will come. We seek the why. We want to know why. And that part of the why is about knowing the Lord very deeply. So in there, after this section that we saw in Deuteronomy chapter 8, there's the another one of the 613 that's been brought up over time. In Deuteronomy 8, verse 10, about, you know, when you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. And that's come down with the practice of offering a blessing for your meal afterward. You know, one of the Pharisaical inventions, which was actually, you could say, a good thing, was that you thank God for your food, you ask for him to bless your food at the beginning, it's very short. Then after you eat, then you have a much longer blessing at the end of it. And part of that was that if you forget the one at the end, at least you've thanked him at the beginning part. And since the time I actually first was reading this, I've been sort of going through on that part of actually being thankful after eating. Wow, I don't know about you, but that is a difficult one to remember. It is a very difficult thing to remember. And we think for us that haven't had these great miraculous things come up, you know, that's maybe not such a huge hassle for us, but it actually is. We can easily forget those things that we can be thankful for, even just having food to eat and such. So that's why, as a part of, kind of alludes to the discipline of humbling yourself by fasting and the points of time when their forefathers were actually physically hungry, physically thirsty at particular times where they were traveling between Egypt and the mountain and then in the years thereafter. But this is something that then goes on further, because once God has given you everything, once he's brought you into the land, do you actually remember where it all came from? Do you actually remember this? And part of that blessing and being thankful for just something like being thankful for your food in a small part is to remember where these blessings, where our you could say, salvation, where our covering, the covering over our sins, transgressions, and iniquities, where that actually comes from. So, you know, when we think about the time of Yom Kippur, thinking about what the Lord is actually covering over in our lives, thinking about the old man, the old woman that gets left behind, and the new man, the new woman that is now moving forward because of the covering that Messiah has given us. So as we cruise on into chapter 9, we see that this really fits well. Deuteronomy chapter 9 fits extremely well with what we just saw, as one of the commands there about being thankful for the things that you have, and when you get the things that the Lord is going to give you, to not forget where they come from. Chapter 9, really good part of chapter 10, it brings in some history lessons again, of some serious cases where forgetting where the blessings and such come from. But a good lesson of chapter 9 and chapter 10 are, don't be haughty. Don't be full of yourself. Don't be arrogant, because the Lord has chosen you and the Lord has set you aside, said, hey, you are going to be sons and daughters of my kingdom. Don't be arrogant, thinking that this is something that you've done in and of yourself. You know, chapter 9 starts out with a couple of good quips in verses 5 and 6. It's not for your righteousness or for the uprightness of your heart that you are going to possess the land. One of the things you often hear today is, well, hey, you know, the modern state of Israel, there's all these atheists. There's all these people who don't believe in Messiah Yeshua there. This is the whole point. One of the things of bringing these people in the land was not about how worthy they were. Oh, they finally became worthy. So now you can go into the land. Got the, you know, the great worthiness check. It's kind of like the metal detector. You got the worthiness detector, and they go through it, and beep, if it turns green, then you can go in the land. If it turns red, then you have to go back and wander around for 40 years. But one of those things that it's brought up again and again and again is that you trust the one who takes you to the place where you need to go. Takes you to this new beginning, this new person that you are going to become. That it's not because of how great you are, but it's great how great He is. That He will cover over your sins, your transgressions, your iniquities, and take you to this new place where you are treated as not guilty. Yes.
Is it because those people were wicked and then they defiled the land? Did they have to clean it afterward? Remember before he said that they're like when you murder someone, it defiles the land. And I can't even think of the right word for that.
Well, as we go on through Deuteronomy, it'll start enumerating some of these reasons why the current inhabitants of the land at this particular time, this was written, the Canaanites and the other ites that were in there, why they weren't allite. It was really a big problem of what they were doing in the land. Some, when it talks about that their wickedness had not yet reached its full, when you start seeing some of the practices and things they dig up archaeologically, there were some pretty reprehensible things that were going on there. And you see it described a little bit later about the worship related to a particular deity. It's called Molech, which just means, you know, king or ruler. But, it's just incredible, especially what is done to children and babies. Just absolutely horrifically. Why you would treat, you know, the most innocent among you with such disdain. So, and not start asking why. So, one of these things that it gets reinforced there as you go through chapter 9 about these particular rebellions, Taberah, Massah, and Kibarot HaTavah. Yeah, for those that just, where those kind of roll off your tongue, those are some particular ones, just if you're jotting them down, Terabah, which is referred to there in Deuteronomy 9:22. That comes from Numbers chapter 11, where there was like the fire that was on the outskirts of the camp, and it was killing some of them, and then they were complaining. They were complaining about adversity. So it was the travel was too hard. So what came as a result? It was like, well, you think this is you have burning problems now? Well, you'll have some burning problems around the outskirts of your camp. So which calamity do you want more? The Massah was a hugely big problem. It's recorded in Exodus chapter 17. And this comes up mentioned a lot, and it's actually a big topic when you go through and read Hebrews chapters 3 and 4, and it keeps mentioning, you know, I swore my wrath, you will not enter my rest. When you start going the Bible chain back through Psalm 95, going back to Exodus 17, you see that this particular incident was a big, big, big problem. And when you read there, especially in chapter 7 of Exodus 17, it mentions the key reason why. The question, are you with us or not? They're asking the Lord, are you with us or not? And if you remember chronologically, Exodus 17, just after the Red Sea crossing, which is a good indicator, hey, the Lord actually is with you. So if the Lord can divide a large body of water so you can pass by and then, you know, take out an entire superpower's army with the same water. Thus, having a water issue is not going to be a problem. If you're lacking water, water won't be a big problem. Do you trust the one who took you through the sea? And for us, you know, we encounter a problem where we encounter our own thirst or hunger, whether it be literal thirst, literal hunger, or something that's just annoying, or gets to be a huge problem, or even gets to be life-threatening, or threatening your whole livelihood and such. Do you trust the one who took you this far, that he will either take you through it, or, you know, this problem may consume you, but it is not because the Lord is lacking. It may be something that you yourself learn through this adversity, or other people learn because of it. Because if you've ever read any of the testimonies of people who died because of their trust in God, that testimony lives long, 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 long beyond their death. So we never know what it is that our death, our suffering, is actually doing to change us into the new man, the new woman, or to change other people and keep them on that path. Yes?
I did read a book on people who were living in such adversity that the soldiers had guns in the faces of these believers, and he told the rest of them, if you don't want to die, get out of here. And so all the people who scrammed, except for the believers, they said, go ahead and shoot me, I don't care. And then once all the other people ran out of the room, the soldier dropped to his knees and begged them to share God with them. I just about cried when I read that, because he knew if he threatened their lives of the people who weren't really, their heart didn't belong to God, they would just run off, and they did. And that left him safe with true believers, because if he got caught, he would have got killed. So it was just amazing to read that kind of, you totally reminded me of that. I just had to share that.
Yeah. And there was even, one of the leaders of the an organization called Voice of the Martyrs, and his testimony is incredible, because he grew up in the Soviet bloc, Eastern Europe, and he was tortured, years and years and years of torture in prison. And one of the things that happened at the end of it was that the person who had tortured him for years and years and years saw how he handled it, that he was like a Paul, like a Peter, singing there in the midst of the suffering. That's at the end of it, he was like, wow, I want to have what you have. I want to know who it is that you serve that's going to keep you like this through after all the stuff that I've done to you. And that one will even say, forgive him. You know, so when you see in the Gospels where it's talking about Yeshua there on the cross, you know, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Because he saw one of those there at the foot. It was like, he cried out, hey, surely this must be the Son of God. Even he in the midst of it realized, wow, this is something different. This is something different than we've ever seen.
He actually forgave.
Yes. Yeah, and he forgave his torturer, and he actually taught his torturer about God. Although he said that the torturer already knew a lot about God, because he talked to him quite a lot about all the time. So his jailer knew very well where that spirit that was within him came from, very much. Yeah, it went on for him for years on that. Yeah, because, and he had no idea that was going to be the result of it. He very well could have died in prison. Yeah, many of our brothers and sisters have died, either in prison or in executions, whatever. But it is in that time of testing, what is it that we are actually going to do under that testing? So, yeah, heavy indeed. So as we go through and the other kind of examples there, it talks about Kirbat Hatavah, which is described also in Numbers chapter 11, which was they're complaining about the manna, or the, you know, the what is it stuff that came 6 days a week and fed them. So they were complaining because, wow, it was boring. So it was like, wow, you've gone from complaining about hunger to now complaining about the food that, that comes to you every day.
That's how crazy.
Yeah, so it's one of those things that we see in the midst of this to recognize the Lord's blessings that are right here in front of us. So as we cruise down, talking about Kadesh Barnea, another thing of, are you going to enter the land? This is the Lord is providing this land. He says, you can go in, the same Lord that's divided the sea, took out the army of Mitzrayim, is now saying, these giants, these high walls, they're not going to stand up. They are not going to get in the way if I say, you are going to go in, and you are going to occupy this land. So as we cross into chapter 10, we get the recounting of the golden calf incident. And kind of skip down to Deuteronomy 10:16, where it talks about circumcising your heart and stiffen your neck no longer. Because thus, when we were talking earlier about the second set of tablets, it says to Moshe, cut these out, bring these tablets up, I'm going to write on them. So just like with the new covenant, the Lord is going to write on your hearts. That term of circumcising your hearts, the cutting off the parts of your heart, the part that's in you that drives you to do what you do. Take those things that are still yearning for the old man, the old woman, the odd old way of life. Cut that stuff off and let it die. And when it talks about stiffen your necks no longer, you often will probably see that reference, the idiom in there about stiffening your neck. Well, what does that mean? It's that you don't bow. You bow to no one. You are arrogant in your own position. So learn where respect is due and give respect to whom respect is due. Yeah, it says, you know, circumcise your heart and stiffen your neck no longer. So the things that have made you arrogant, cut those things off. The things that, when it talks about earlier, we've gone through Numbers and it talked about the leaders of tens and fifties and hundreds and thousands. Well, that only works if people actually listen to. And those who are put in charge are, you know, wise, faithful people who carry out justice, do not pervert justice. They know the boss who they're working for, and they abide by it. But then everyone there that is responsible to them, and they are responsible for, it is also to them to respect that authority. Even to those who you don't like. And you know, I keep bringing back that example of the people think of the great leaders that we've had in the Bible. Yosef and Daniel. Think about who their bosses were. You know, Yosef, you could say, well, that leader at least knew where the power was. And when he saw those things, saw the miracles, heard about the visions, saw the interpretations that Yosef gave, he knew where the true power was. So you saw the deference then given to Yosef, and then to his father, Yaakov, when he finally came down and his family came down, that respect going from this head of a superpower back, because he realized, hey, the one who is the Lord, who is behind Yosef, is a great power. And sadly, another occupier of the Pharaoh, because the Pharaoh is a term of a, really is a term of a building rather than a person. We say, the White House says this, the White House says that. The White House did this, the White House did that. That is actually a kind of similar term of what Pharaoh is. It just means building. So it's the etymology of it is thought to be actually Hebrew, which ended up into ancient Egyptian. It just means the house of the big guy. So the house of the big guy knew who the actual big guy was at that particular time. A later big guy had to learn through the plagues, the Exodus and such, who was actually in charge, and that those deities weren't actually in charge. So that lesson that even the guy in the big house had to learn there in Egypt was something that those who came out of the house of bondage had to learn. They had to learn it going through those various trials, tests, deprivations moving forward. They had to cut that part off. Now, one of the things I'd like to do in closing, the Haftarah, I hope you all read it, or the parallel reading that kind of goes along with Akev, or this passage in Deuteronomy that we're looking at from chapter 7 through chapter 11. It comes from Isaiah chapter 49, starting verse 14 and going through 51 verse 3. Now, it's kind of long and involved, but I invite you to go back and take a look at it, because Daniel has brought up in a lot of previous occasions about chiasms. And lo and behold, there are chiasms that are involved in these as well. And this particular chiasm, you see, starting first off in Isaiah 49:7 through chapter 50, verse 3, that you'll see that there are kind of like three main topics that get, or you'd say four main topics that where it gets down to the middle. If you're not kind of familiar with the term of a chiasm, chi is the Greek letter X, and so it roughly refers to a kind of a literary structure where you have parts of it repeat. You may have wondered when you're reading through the Bible why it is it kind of sounds repetitive. It's like, I read that before. Well, it's not just because people needed to, like, it's not like a term paper you had to hit your word limit, so you just kind of padded. No, it's an ancient technique. It's actually incredibly ingenious, because you think about how you have to write something like this, and that a good chunk of the Bible is written this way. Wow, you talk about the the inspiration that goes into something like this. But a point of this kind of a literary structure that you'll see throughout the Bible is to focus one's attention to a main point. This is kind of like in ancient writing, you know, boldface, underline, put it in red, and you know, circle it, put big bubble around it. When it hits the middle of this structure of a particular passage, this is saying, hey, this is the point of what this message is. So in this particular thing, in this whole passage, you're seeing, and which is why it's a parallel to our passage in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is talking about, don't be so full of yourself. Remember where it is you come from. And remember who brought you there. Remember how you got there. And be a different person when you get to your destination, to the place where the Lord is taking you. Don't be the same person like where you started. Be different. So thus, when you see these passages in Isaiah, they're echoing. Now remember, this is one of the downslides of Israel's history. Yeah, about 15,000 years later, at least, where you're entering a point of exile. So this is talking to the future. So where Deuteronomy is talking to the second generation coming out from Egypt, going into the land, Isaiah is talking to this generation, which is going to go back into the land eventually. So where it says here that this Redeemer, you see the Redeemer is repeated on 49:7 through 11, and then repeated down 49:20 through 50 verse 3, this Redeemer, who is the one who's actually doing this? And that is the Holy One of Israel. And the promise, this people is going to come. You see it from 49, 12 through 13. You see it repeated again in 49, 22 through 23 of Isaiah. That, again, the message repeated, they're going to come in, carried in from wherever they are, scattered all about. So don't be worried that they are scattered off. Because the Lord knows where they are, and the Lord is going to bring them in. Why is that? It's because kind of emphasizes further in 49, 14 through 15. Can a mother forget her infant, be without tenderness for the child of her womb? Remember we were talking earlier about faithfulness, love equaling faithfulness, not just kind of lovey-dovey, oh, I'm swooning at a particular moment, you know. We are not like the song that is not good to remember, you know, love the one you're with. No, that's not the way God works. This is, you stay with the one who brought you this far because of that faithfulness that the person who brought you has to you. Be as faithful back as the one who brought you this far. And that is echoed again in Isaiah 49, 20, 21. It talks about, well, who has borne all of these people that are scattered out there? Where did they all come from? Focusing in on the message. There in Isaiah 49, 16 through 19. They are all gathering. These that are scattered out, they're all gathering and they're coming. They are going to return. So you see when the Apostle Paul there in Romans, like starting in verse in chapter 9, goes on through 11, is fretting about why it is that his own countrymen, native born of Israel, just can't get it of that, you know, the Messiah has come with Yeshua. He's like, well, the Lord actually does have a plan. The Lord has a plan of what he's doing. And in the process, yes, there are those that have been scattered out, but he's going to gather those in. And not only just those that have been scattered and their descendants way on down, but also anyone who wants to get grafted in, anyone who wants to sign in with the Holy One of Israel. So thus we see that being the focus. And so the next one in Isaiah chapter 50, 4 through 11, one of the things that we see, the messages there about listening, help, and he is near who upholds the one who is righteous. He is near who upholds the one who is righteous. But one of the things that you'll see in this, and also as it goes on further on in chapter 51 and 52 of Isaiah, it's like, pay attention. Yes, the Lord has this plan of bringing things back, restoring what was lost, building up the things that were knocked down. But you have to be awake. You have to listen. Shema, that's this. And you'll see it there in Isaiah 54 through 5. He opens my ear that I may hear. Lishema. Again, in chapter 50, 10 through 11. Who among you fears the Lord, heeds Shema, his servant's voice. So yes, when the Lord is coming with the plan, with the way of escape, are we actually listening? Do we actually hear that call? And as it focuses in, this one who upholds the righteous is near. He is coming. This is going to happen. May not be on our timetable, but it is going to happen. And kind of the last chunk for this particular Hatzorai, or the parallel reading here from Isaiah, in chapter 51, 1 through 52, 12, this kind of covers the periods of, again, wake up. Yeah, the place is a mess. The ruins of Yerushalayim. The place is a mess. But in the midst of the mess, The Lord still sees his people. Yes, the place is knocked down. The place is destroyed. This is kind of the pre-exile return period. So the land is, you know, walls knocked down. You had, especially in the later dominations of Babylon, you've had reoccupation. Syria did as well to a certain degree. Reoccupation, bringing in other people in. That's where you later on have the Samaritans, because you have people that were imported in and they end up intermarrying with some of the people who are already there. But the key point that we have in this particular passage is awake. So you see these passages repeated again and again. Awake, awake, put on your strength. But what, again, focuses on who is it who's the actual strength? The Lord is the strength. The Lord is the one who makes those broken down walls, rebuilds them. And for us, you know, when we are broken down, we are, you know, full of shame. Because when you think of guilt and shame, you know, guilt is for, okay, yeah, there's a good reason why it is that you feel bad. But then shame, that could come from guilt, but it can also be from a lifetime of self-talk. You know, if your parents talked about how dumb and how stupid they were, and then, heaven forbid, they actually have told you that you're dumb and you're stupid, that kind of filters down into you. So you've got this shame that just continues on like a plague, like a black cloud that's over your head all the time. So for us, our old life, as we go forward, we want us to be treated just like ancient Israel was. That even as, after all that they have done, after all that's happened, the affronts against the Lord, the one who took them that far, the one who took them into the land, that even then, that he would say, forgive. Forgive, forgive. And not only forgive, but as it's mentioned a number of times, to put your sins as far as the east is from the west. To forget them. To remember them no more. And that's a part of the New Covenant prophecy. That he will remember these things no more. So, when we see this great promise that we have in this passage that we're looking at here in Deuteronomy, now you can see why it was that Messiah, when he was tempted in the wilderness those 40 days, 40 nights, at the end of it, he was tempted one of those times about making bread. If you're the Son of God, just turn these stones into bread. That's what the adversary told him. When you're talking about the Son of God, the Lord, the part of through whom the world was made, would turning stones into bread be a big deal? No. Not a big deal at all. But what was the bigger thing? Just like what we talked about earlier, is... Yeah, that was something also that was brought up later on when people were talking about their heritage and the fact that they were descendants from Abraham. Well, as we mentioned in a previous occasion, that our heritage is not just our biological heritage. Our heritage is what has come down to us. Because, you know, it's very popular now to do genetic testing. And you can go in there and look at your DNA and go back and discover all kinds of people that you've never heard of. But what is their legacy to you? DNA? Great. Great. So you know that you came from this part of England or that part of Spain or this part of Scotland or whatnot and the other. But what more is there to that? Nothing. Unless perhaps something has come down to you, like is what has been done in many hundreds of years past, and it's kind of gone into disuse a lot is, say, like the family Bible, or passing down a legacy, what your parents saw in the Word and passing that along to you. What is it that they have passed along to you? That's the thing that really lasts. So as we wrap up today, and our passage here kind of ends with the last part of chapter 10 and into chapter 11 with kind of these staccato ordinances again in chapter 10 verses 19 and 20. You've got this kind of staccato thing where it talks about loving strangers, fearing the Lord, and cleaving to the Lord, and swearing only by the name of the Lord. So those are like bam, 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 bam. Those are what people have seen as part of the 613 of the commandments that people have come up with. So from that, where then do we get the application, the statutes? Where is it the case law that comes out from that? About loving strangers, fearing and cleaving to the Lord. How then is that applied going further? How is that applied about loving strangers, fearing and cleaving to the Lord, swearing, making oaths only by the name of the Lord? Yeah, good, good. Well, kind of like what we were starting out our discussion here today, talking about commandments, and they're given various titles in English, but you know, you have commandments and ordinances and then statutes. But you think of them basically as your core principles. Those are like the Ten Commandments. Then you've got the ones that come out of the Ten Commandments. Those were where the ten becomes, you know, 613. And then out of the 613, and where then does that get applied into how you actually live your life? And so as you filter that down, about loving the stranger, what is the application of that? Because you were strangers in the land where you were coming from. Okay, so that is when we talk about our big topic that we're all talking about, the first commandment. I'm the one who took you out of the house of bondage. Have no other gods before me. So with this one about loving strangers, loving someone who is other, someone coming from not your group, to love them. Well, why is that? Because the Lord loved you, took you from where you were. Remember when Paul talks about those who are far off being brought near? Talked about that in Leviticus as we were talking about the tabernacle, bringing people from the outside into the presence of God by way of the offerings, the korbanot, the things that bring near. That is bringing the stranger from God to close, to the friend of God, the heir of the kingdom of God. And that is something that God not only does for us, so then that we do that to other people. We extend that same sort of mercy on other people that God has had upon us. And as Daniel talked about extensively last time, about cleaving to God. I love the illustration you had about this, like children, you know, hanging on your leg and having to drag them around on your leg because they want to be with you so much. Yes, we have a comment over here.
My mom having surgery, and this lady, I said something about cleaving to the Lord, and she told me a story about a friend of hers was so passionate about animals that got hit on the road, and she said that her friend pulled her car over, and a possum had gotten hit, and I said, what? So she's telling the story. And she said, yes, the mother has babies, and the mother passed away, and she picked it up, and there were clung all the little baby possums. And I was like, wow, what an analogy, that even in death, that the little possums stay connected to the mother all on the inside. And I said, wow, what a story. Because, you know, of course, my mom's going in for surgery. We're freaking out. She's the nurse that had come in. And that was her story. I think she was from England. That was her story of comfort. And I was like, wow, I can envision that little animal. She says, I know it's an ugly creature. She said, but the babies stay clung to the mother. And I thought about that today when I was coming here and I heard cling to Yeshua. And I thought, gee, can you imagine being in an accident? And then the little thing stuck to the mommy. It was so cute, you know? And when you said that cling, made me think of that. So just a little story. Clinging to your mom.
Yeah, and
add on to that.
Uh-oh.
One night when I lived in Tahoe, it was a full moon and I could see clearly, and there was a mama possum and she had 5 babies and they were literally hung on to each other, hanging on to the mom. Huh. And then the mom she chirped at them and I just stood back watching. She chirped at them and the little babies all clung to each other. Mama ran across the street and got underneath another vehicle. And then all of a sudden she chirped at them again and they all ran to mama. It was just precious to see that.
Yeah. So as we close up today, hopefully in this we're talking about elaborating on getting more information about the first commandment. That when it's talking about, you know, have no other gods before me, hopefully now you can see a little bit more about what is in the heart of God. Because Deuteronomy, you get a really good picture of the heart of God in these examples, these explanations of what the Ten Commandments are all about. So in the next passage that we're going to look at next week, we're going to be getting into the Second Commandment. So as you look through there, as you have those little outlines of the book, think about that as you're reading through and some of the things that you just wonder how on earth any of this has to do with anything else. Was this all just kind of thrown together, just put into a bag? You have to get them in there somehow, so we just put them in here like this. But rather, look at them as explaining, kind of fully laying out that this is what the Lord means. Any last thoughts before we close out? All right, let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us a look into your heart, explaining these things through the testimony of your servants. And Father, we thank you for giving us a full look at your heart in action through your Son, Yeshua. We thank you for covering over our sins, transgressions, and iniquities, for writing on our hearts, changing our hearts each day, transforming us from who we were to who you want us to be. And Father, we just pray that you'll continue to remind us throughout this coming week where we come from and where we're going. We thank you for all these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's hallel.info. Hillel.info.